air raids of yesterday and last night only a few hours past, it is reported this morning that German bombers and fighting planes are again over southeast British coastal towns.
I'm not good at getting up early, really early. I mean, and even in summer, the really early morning air at 4 a.m. is chilly. But this has compensations. For after you've overcome the revulsion of getting out of a warm bed, there is something exhilarating and thrilling at that hour of the morning, especially when there is the prospect of a flying trip ahead. As a rule, it's a good thing to have a cup of tea or something hot and a biscuit. It helps towards waking you up. That was written for Over to You, a series of broadcasts by the RAF during the Second World War. What our man needed was a fine cup of Chocs Away from Tactical Tea. Chocs Away is a white tea, decent in a dogfight and rising above the rest through adversity to the stars. Tactical Tea offer a wide variety of teas, white, black, fruit and herbal. To order your supply, head over to tacticaltea.uk and use the code WW2podcast for 10% off your order. Tactical Tea, waging war on bad brews. Hello and welcome to the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. When we think of the Allied war effort, it is all too easy to overlook some of the junior partners. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Mexico's commitment to the Second World War. The Mexican Expeditionary Force would serve in the Philippines as the 201st Fighter Squadron, known as the Aztec Eagles. I'm joined by now regular of the podcast, Walter Zapotachny, whose new book is The Aztec Eagles, The Forgotten Allies of the Second World War. But before we kick off, just a quick reminder, this podcast is brought to you by the small donations from listeners like yourself. A dollar or two every month from each of you goes a long way to helping me find the time to put the show together. The band of loyal listeners do not go unrewarded. Now, for instance, I was able to make available last year to patrons of the show an extra 27 minutes of Robert Trigg and I discussing issues around Operation Barbarossa. So to find out more, go to patreon.com/WW2podcast. And it's a big thank you to those of you who already support the show with a small contribution each month. It really is appreciated. Walter, welcome back. It's nice to chat with you again. Where did Mexico politically stand in 1939 when the war broke out? Was Mexico close to Germany? I guess it must be remembered that during the First World War, Germany tried to woo Mexico into joining the Central Powers. We have the whole Zimmermann telegram debacle.
Well, I don't think they weren't close to them. There were many Mexican citizens who wanted to side on the side of the Axis, many who didn't. But sending men to fight with the United States was an unpopular move on many Mexican politicians and citizens before the war. You know, the memory of the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe was still fresh in many minds. The Zimmermann telegram, as you pointed out, that further exasperated the relations between Mexico and the United States. Mexico did not seem to have any interest in the war's European origins, or would the accession of Japanese dominance in the Pacific have any particular harm to Mexico as they saw it. However, I think when we look at the close cooperation, economic cooperation between the United States and Mexico, it really meant that in the eyes of the enemies of the United States, the two were indistinguishable. I mean, I don't know that they really looked at the United States and Mexico, to some extent, even Central America, some parts of it, as separate. They were all part of this Western thing, you know? So worried by the potential of an unstable government in Mexico, the states began to provide open and secret aid to the Mexican government. Some economic cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico resulted when the U.S. purchased silver from Mexico and they granted U.S. government-backed loans. But what really it boiled down to was the two blunders that Germany made that swung the public opinion in favor of siding with the Allies. when the German submarine U-564 torpedoed and sank the Mexican oil tanker, and then on May 14th, 1942, and then U-106 sank another ship on the 21st, that really took the Mexicans by surprise. You know, of course, from the Germans' perspective, you know, it's an oil tanker filled with product that's going to help the Allies. So, you know, they didn't distinguish. Mexico asked Germany to compensate them for the losses. Germany refused. And then on the 22nd of May, 42, Mexico declared war.
Were they Mexican flagged ships then that went down, or were they just carrying Mexican fuel?
They were Mexican flagships, yes.
Were they heading to the US or heading to the UK?
They were heading to the US with oil. Mexico provided quite a bit of oil to the United States.
But wasn't there some contention over Mexican oil? They'd nationalized the oil, hadn't they, from American companies?
They did nationalize the oil industry because American companies were basically taking the oil, paying the workers very little, and Mexico really didn't think they were getting anything out of the deal. So they nationalized the oil industry. And that caused a major problem between the United States and Mexico during the time, because there were U.S. companies, of course, that were processing the oil, you know. But it resolved itself, if you will, with the war.
Well, it's because it's not something that's necessarily going to tie the two countries together, is it? My line of thought is not as if they were directly politically close, Mexico and America. So if we look at the Mexican military, you know, during the interwar years, most countries preferred not to spend any money on the military until the close of the 30s, where it's almost in panic when people start rearming. What are the Mexicans doing in the interwar years? Are they spending a lot of money on the military?
In 1920, there was about 80,000 Mexicans under arms. There were factions within the organization that were loyal to some leaders, and others were loyal to others. The numbers changed over the years as leaders, new presidents came on board. They really never became a comprehensive fighting force that could, let's say, fight overseas. They were involved in local conflicts, putting down revolts and local affairs. The Air Force, there really wasn't. The Air Force was, I guess it was an Air Force, if you will, but they were involved more in mapping and reconnaissance and those types of things, and air shows. You know, they didn't spend a lot of money on the army per se, and of course the aviation portion of it. A lot of the pilots that flew in that infant Air Force, if you will, had been trained in the United States. They got their flight training there, and they came back. And that's just the way they did it. Wasn't any motive for it necessarily, but there were instructors in the United States, and there were a lot more instructors. So they didn't spend a lot of money, and it was a very small force. And, you know, war came, and they started to realize, what's going to happen here? Is Japan going to invade Mexico to get the United States? You know, is Germany going to do that? You know, so the political discussion started, and, you know, it was kind of cut them down the road to, you know, where they are. And of course, Roosevelt was keen to bring Mexico into the war. You know, when he came in, he tried to implement what he called the good neighbor policy. You know, he wanted to solidify the inter-American alliance against the fascists, you know. When World War II started, the U.S. desperately needed Mexico's cooperation. They needed the oil, and they were going to do whatever it took to do that. There was some discussion even in the United States that if necessary, they would have to invade Mexico to capture the oil to supply the war effort.
But if the Mexicans come in into the war on the side of the Allies, did they even need to send any contingent to fight? I mean, they commit to sending an air contingent, which, considering they don't really have an air force at this period, you'd have thought they might have sent some military. Why do they feel the need to send anything?
The main thing, of course, that changed the political dialogue was the German submarine attacks, sinkings of those two ships, and then, as more and more people looked at that, politicians and even the citizens, they began to think, well, you know, we're probably not going to be able to stay out of this conflict. So we know we need to get involved somehow. So how is that going to be? That's what that discussion started to take. That road that discussion started to take.
So why do they send the Air Force if they don't really have an Air Force, you know, as an organization?
Well, they didn't have an army, and President Cardenas knew that he was a Mexican army general. You know, he knew that the army could never be ready in time. There just wasn't enough people. There wasn't enough funds. And it really wasn't the desire on the part of the United States to bring up a full-blown Mexican army just south of their border. Okay, but he believed that the Air Force could have been brought up, and with the help of the United States, with more modern planes and training, they could participate in the war. They were small. They were underfunded. They had no indigenous aircraft industry at the time, but he felt that that was the best course to take. And with the United States help, they could participate and contribute to some extent in the war.
So how do you recruit an Air Force when you've not really got an existing Air Force program, as it were?
Camacho was confident that he could supply troops to the Allied cause. So he lobbied for military and public support, knowing full well that the Air Force would be much smaller. He would go around, give speeches to graduating classes, specifically at the Mexican National Military Academy. He would speak at luncheons, and he provided a lot of information that many of the newspapers printed, as well as the New York Times, printed about Mexicans needed to fight abroad. They were ready to go. So there were a lot of volunteers that were eager to serve in what was termed as this elite force that was being put together. So come and be part of this elite group. Yeah. And it was, certainly. They selected about 300 to serve in the squadron. The group included 36 pilots, the remainder of ground forces, ground personnel listed in an officer. And the thing that was, that I'd mentioned before, which was, I think, added to this whole idea of willingness to serve, is that about two-thirds of the pilots that eventually ended up as part of the squadron had received flight training in the United States. So they were familiar with United States kind of way of flying and a way of doing things. And there were volunteers from all areas of Mexico, from the north to the south, both coasts, very eager to join. And it was kind of like let's do this. This is a national pride is at stake here, and we need to be part of this.
So they're trained in the U.S. How are they received in the U.S. training skills? How does the training go? Because if you're coming from nowhere, it must be quite hard to. Are they just literally copying the whole lot of the American training system, the doctrine, everything essentially adopted into the U.S. Air Force?
Well, the 300 men approximately that I mentioned entered the U.S. at Laredo, Texas on July 25th, 44. And, of course, they were the first Mexican military organization to ever leave the country with a war mission. So it was a big deal, big send-off, a lot of speeches, families were there, there's pictures of women giving flowers through the windows of the trains as they're going north. And I think the decision was made to send them to Randolph Field in San Antonio initially was more motivated by the geographical proximity to Mexico and possibly the presence of a lot of Spanish-speaking personnel. However, they were also immediately exposed to the institutional racism that was taking place in American society at the time. They were subjected to the same bigotry and segregation as Black Americans. When they rolled into Major's Army Airfield in Greenville, Texas, one of the first tasks undertaken by the American liaison officers was to convince the local store owners to take the signs down that they had placed that said, no Mexicans, no dogs. And they had banners made up and strung across the streets with that saying. Not that prejudice ended at the base perimeter. Very few instructors were interested in training the Mexican pilots, and those that were allegedly bilingual, they only provided rudimentary skills. information. In practice, which is really interesting, and I had never realized this until I started researching this, that the pilots received much of their instruction from the women's air service pilots, or WASPs. Yeah. The squadrons divided according to specialties and went to different training centers. The largest went to Idaho at the Republican Aviation Corporation and Farmingdale. They went to Long Island, New York. Others went to Boca Raton, Florida, which, by the way, is where my father started his basic training. Scott Field in Illinois, and so on. And then after their individual specialty training was completed, they all came back to Texas to form as a unit. Interestingly, they were nicknamed at that point when they came back together, the Aztec Eagles. So we wonder, well, how did they come up with that name? The Mexican press named them after this elite Aztec warrior, the elite Aztec warriors of Mexico's history. You know, the Eagle Warriors or Eagle Knights, this elite group. So it all falls into this idea of an elite organization, bringing up the status of the organization in the eyes of the Mexican people. You know, we're out there, you know, Mexico's first group to ever leave the country, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They were very, very proud. They pushed through the racism. They pushed through the lack of comprehensive flight training that American pilots would have gotten and still passed the tests, enabling them in the new P-47 Thunderbolt to be able to go fly combat missions.
Were they all expected? I presume they're all expected to speak English.
Yes, that's correct. And they did. Some of the ground crew had difficulty, but the pilots spoke English. Some not as good as others, of course, but enough to, I mean, English is the international flight language. It was then too. So, you know, they knew that. And they spoke enough that they certainly could fly.
They shipped to the Philippines, don't they? But are they essentially just a unit in the American Army that happened to be Mexican? So they're essentially, you know, they're not under their own command, as it were, command structure.
The decision was made to attach them to the 5th Air Force's 58th Fighter Group. And the 201st, which is what they were, 201st Fighter Group, was attached as the 4th Squadron, although it operated under Mexican command and administration and occupied in its own area in part of the Clark Field in the Philippines. So they were part of the American 5th Air Force, but they had, again, they had their own command and control structure within their own organization. Still, as any fighter group or squadron, they would have to answer to, you know, planning and the administration, higher administration of the United States Air Force.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to you in a moment.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to the World War II podcast. They get to the Philippines in, it's May 45, isn't it? Which is quite, it really is towards the end of the war. What's the situation like in the Philippines when they arrive? Is there still much action going on?
Throughout June, the campaign to liberate Luzon continued as the U.S. 6th Army fought north toward Cagayan Valley, which was in the Central Highlands, where the Japanese 14th Army was holding out in the caves. You know, they advanced through rugged terrain passes, over valleys, you know, ancient rice paddies, and close air support was critical. And as the fighting moved deeper into the mountains, the 201st mission changed from hitting visible targets to striking hard-to-see troops and fortified positions that were in fairly close proximity to their friendly forces. Fundamentally, the mission of the squadron was carried out in basically June 45 and concentrated on strafing and bombing of various targets. And of course, the target selections were done by the 5th Air Force people, higher level. And those missions came down and to the various squadrons, of which the 201st was one. and then they flew those missions.
So it's still a very active combat zone. Is there much Japanese aviation still flying at that point, or is it all just ground?
There wasn't really any Japanese aviation flying at that point. There's ground fire, of course, but the Japanese Air Force was done at that point.
What's the Philippines like for the men? What are their facilities like? It's not Clarkville they're flying from. It's a subsidiary, isn't it?
Well, when they went into, they reached Porec, which was part of the airfield. They began to, it was a separate area, actually opposite from where the rest of the 50th Fighter Group was. They began to set up camp in an area that was kind of separated by some hills and some jungle, stifling heat, incessant mosquitoes. They raised tents and built septic tanks, latrines, medical quarters, et cetera. The sleeping quarters were rudimentary at best, tents, dirt floors. They were able to scrounge up some lumber to put that down on the floors. And because when it rained, it was a big mud hole. Water drainage was a problem because it rained a lot in the Philippines. And of course, every man, every airman and mechanic had to use mosquito netting to protect themselves. So it wasn't the most pleasant environment, but they pushed through.
How were they viewed by their American comrades once they're in the field? Were they just seen as another unit, or was there sort of some of that institutional racism sort of still bubbling away under the surface?
Well, there was institutional racism bubbling against the surface, and there was more than just that. There was the 58th Fighter Group had been in combat for a while, and they'd flown a lot of combat missions in various places. And there was this feeling that, they're still flying with patched up aircraft and, here comes this 201st Fighter Squadron, Mexican Aztec Eagles with brand new P-47 Thunderbolts. They didn't deserve them. They're getting all these accolades about their participation. They're getting the chance to set up a separate area, command themselves, so to speak. So there was jealousy. There was this, it's them. they're not part of us. They're Mexican. They can't even speak English right. Those kinds of things. But they did fly together. I mean, I think what happens too in many units, not just this, when it comes right down to executing the mission, I think most forget the ethnicity, the race. We do the mission. And then somehow after the mission's over, it bubbles up again, whatever it is. I've seen that from my own experience in the military. I mean, when it comes right down to flying, I was in aviation for a long time. It didn't matter who you were, you flew, you just did what you needed to do, But then you got separate again. I'm not going to drink a beer with you, but I'll fly with you, kind of thing, I think that's kind of like it was there.
They the 58th get posted to Okinawa, but the 201st don't. Am I right? So they don't go.
On July 24th, Brigadier General Freddie H. Smith Jr. was the commander of the 5th Fighter Command, and he recommended that the Aztec Eagles be retained in the Philippines. In his opinion, he said they should remain there until such time as their operational efficiency was brought to a level to ensure success in combat operations. Close quote. Well, they had already flown pretty successfully. I mean, they did a lot of missions, but he was prejudiced against them. In the minds of many others, they were combat ready and they should have gone. But his opinion, was accepted. And to this day, there's a debate on whether the decision was racially motivated, whether there were some issues about combat efficiency, and we'll probably never know. Whether it was the ideologies between the way Mexico wanted to operate or back to their countries, who knows? But many people respected their flying ability. Apparently he did not, and he had to fly away.
So they fly 791 sorties, which seems like a lot for 26 pilots when you're saying they're not up for it. They've certainly put in quite a lot of, nearly 3,000 hours of flying.
Yeah, 2,842 hours or so. That's a lot. Dropped almost 2,000 bombs. Yeah, they did a lot in the short period of time that they were there. So for Smith to to propose that they weren't combat ready, I don't know.
My assumption as well is when you talk about the Pacific, that for the flyers, the oddity is there's quite a lot of time when they can't fly because the weather's against them. Now, it might be that in the time that they were there, the weather was great. but usually when people say, well, the clouds wrong, the rain, and you can't fly. So to do a lot of missions in a relatively short period of time, it is quite a big thing, I would have thought. But
well, it is. And if in the book, I have each of the missions they flew, a small blurb on what the missions were about. And you'll note, one will note that many of them were called back because of weather or other circumstances, but they still flew a lot.
How did their performance, so at the end of the war, how does their performance compare with their US counterparts? Is there a way of measuring them up against one another?
I didn't find the a direct measurement between the members of the 58th and them. It's probably out there somewhere, but at the time I was writing the book, I didn't find it. But they received wide recognition from General MacArthur and others. He recommended the award of the Legion of Honor to several of the pilots. They did lose some pilots and other members during the conflict and during training. For the same period of time, the missions, they carried out more missions than many of the American pilots. And so many in the American high command looked highly at the Aztec Eagles. You pointed out, it seems like a lot of hours flown. Yeah, it really is. There's a lot of missions, a lot of activity done in that short period of time that they were there. You know, I can't give you the exact right now. I'm sure it's out there somewhere. But suffice it to say that for the amount of time that they were there, they flew a lot.
So when they return home, do they come home as heroes? Is it lauded as a big thing, the Foreign Service being part of the war?
They came back as national heroes. There were parades, there were activities. Just about every town had some type of patriotic display. Town plazas were decorated in red, white, green banners, which is their colors. Colors of the Mexican flag. When I retired from the military in 2009, my wife and I moved to Baja California, Mexico, and we visited a lot of these little towns and villages. And I saw some monuments, small monuments to the Aztec Eagles. And one of the people we got to Mexican national that we befriended, still friends to this day. Once he found out that I was writing and I was an historian, he said, "Well, you should write about the Aztec Eagles." I didn't really know what the Aztec Eagles were all about. And he's the one that kind of got me looking at it and interested in doing the research about it. But to this day, you can go to towns and they talk about him in the schools, in the high schools. There's stories about the Aztec Eagles. Again, you know, they were promoted as this elite national heroes. Look what they did for Mexico. And they did a lot. They helped end the isolation of Mexico. You know, they paved the way for important agreements between the U.S. and Mexico. They helped modernize the Mexican Air Force, and they demonstrated that they could, in fact, mount a successful expeditionary force. There was a school built in their honor, which still teaches kids to this day. There's parades to this day in certain villages from where some of the pilots and other members came from. So they haven't been forgotten. And they certainly helped the Allies defeat Japan.
Remarkable that for such a small cadre of men to be so well remembered. It might be just because they are such a small cadre of men that they are so well remembered. And I never thought the diplomatic outcome is probably far bigger than their contribution to the war, being seen to be part of the war for Mexico.
Yeah, had Mexico decided not to send forces or materiel, and they sent more than just oil, raw materials as well, the United States to support the war effort and other allies. You know, I wonder what would have happened. Would we have invaded Mexico? You know, would the Germans have invaded because they now had a southern foot? I mean, there's so many questions Mexican Aztec Eagles probably because of their participation, because of Mexico's willingness to put forth this effort, and provide this force never really came to be. You know, I mean, those things didn't come to be.
Remarkable. So did they disband after the war, or did they become sort of the cadre of a new Mexican Air Force?
The Mexican Expeditionary Air Force was disbanded, which was the group that was put together to administratively take care of sending the 201st Fighter Group. The 201st Fighter Group is still active to this day. They fly training aircraft. The 58th Fighter Group, United States 58th Fighter Group, was inactivated after the war. They've since come back together in fast-moving jets. Five of the Aztec Eagle pilots became generals. Others went on to distinguished careers in aviation, business, academia.
Well, presumably, they make great connections during the war, and they probably are the cream of their crop socially. And if they weren't, they certainly would be by the time they returned from the war, well-decorated young men.
Yes, they were. Absolutely.
Which is quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. So, Aztec Eagles, what's next on the list of on your to-do list?
Well, I also am working on my PhD. And I've completed all of the compulsory exams and so on. So I'm now into the dissertation writing stage.
And what's your PhD?
I'm looking at the motivating factors that caused the members of the 28th Infantry Division to fight so strongly to delay the Germans during the Battle of the Bulge for those first couple days that eventually enabled the Allies to move forces into Bastogne. And so much has been written about it. I've even written about it, as you know, 110th book.
Yeah.
None of us have really examined the reasons why they fought so strongly. You know, there's certainly books written about what motivates soldiers in combat, but I was a 28th Division historian, as you know, and I have access to many interviews, and I've done many interviews myself of World War II veterans. And there's a couple things that come loud and clear that really haven't been identified in some of the other writings, religious faith, camaraderie, other things. And I want to investigate that further and to see to what extent those factors motivated them. So that's basically what it's about.
That's a fascinating book, because you've got, there's a book about the British, that I own and I've not read, about morale in the desert and how that the change in morale just with the change of commanders is actually a massive contributing factor. And who else was I talking to? I was talking to Robert Forsyth, who pointed out, and it hadn't occurred to me, he said, you know, when you're winning, it's a massive ego boost for men. You become invincible. And you think, well, actually, the Germans, it's a big counterattack. But actually, up until then, they'd been winning the Americans and the British in Northwest Europe. I mean, romped across Northwest Europe.
Well, I visited Luxembourg a couple of times and worked with some of the, and Belgium and Germany, worked with some of the local historians to try to figure out, you know, what really happened. Where did it happen? We walked the battlefield, you know, many times, and artillery placements on the German side and those types of things. But again, we've never really addressed for sure what those motivating factors were. And in many cases, they fought to the last man. They had no ammunition left. And the German generals after the war wrote that they not been so successful in delaying them, they would have blown right through Bastogne onto Antwerp. And, you know, who knows if they would have captured Antwerp. The war wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have won the, I mean, they wouldn't have won the war, but it probably would have changed the complexion of it a bit, and how many months it would have been delayed, how many people would have lost their lives as a result of us losing the Deepwater port.
It's a fascinating question, actually. Why did, what motivates, because in some respects, you know, the Germans and the Russian, what motivates them is often that if they give in, they'll be shot by their own sides. But the Americans knew full well that they won't be shot by their own people, and actually the Germans would accept them. Chances are the Germans would accept them as prisoners of war. So there is a get out. So what does motivate them to hang on through grit?
And to come up with these unique tactics to delay the Germans. I mean, you know, I wrote about it some in my 110th book, but it was just one of the regiments. But we're going to look at it all in the dissertation.
Well, Walter, I look forward to reading your thesis once you've finished. We'll get you back for a chat. Loyal listener, if you want to know more about the Mexican contribution to the war, Walter's book is Aztec Eagles, the Forgotten Allies of the Second World War. Next time, I think we'll be looking at African-American Medal of Honor winners. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.